Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why do sustainable business initiatives so often fail? What fundamental changes do we need from societies and the economic system to stem a climate change-induced collapse? These are some of the issues covered in the book, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Corporations, Processes of Creative Self-Destruction. The authors are with us now. Daniel Nyberg is a professor of management at the University of Newcastle School of Business. And Professor Christopher Wright is with us, and he is a professor of organizational studies at the University of Sydney. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us to talk about climate change, capitalism, and corporations, what you guys call creative self-destruction. Obviously, we know climate change is upon us. You've suggested that the corporate response is clearly inadequate, and what it is really doing is business as usual, perhaps literally. If you were going to describe sort of the thumbnail sketch of the big problem around both the mythology and the activities, how would you put that into a synopsis for general audiences to really grasp? Christopher Wright, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So I think the basic problem is that we've had two centuries of industrial development and unparalleled economic growth, improvements in health and lifespans and what have you. And that's been based upon the use of fossil fuel energy, coal, oil, and gas. And so our understanding of a modern global capitalist economic system is basically predicated upon the consumption and use of coal, oil, and gas at ever-increasing quantities as the global economy has grown. And the economic system is predicated upon continuous economic growth ad infinitum, compound economic growth. So we have essentially a fundamental problem, a systemic problem in the nature through which we organize our global economy, which is compound economic growth, cheap fossil fuel energy. And we've now reached a point where we're pushing up against the boundaries of physics and chemistry and biology. And we now have to try and unpick that fundamental logic, which of course is very, very difficult. And as we've seen, the time span that we have to do that has become shorter and shorter and shorter.
So it's really this thing that you guys said in the book, which is that climate change really is also a product of our economic system.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's the basic argument. Daniel, do you want to chip in on that?
Yeah, no, it's only that it's the basis. It's also the continuation that we found alarming and fascinating in that we found new ways of doing this. And this is points to this, I guess, what we call the creative self-destruction, in that we not only rely upon, you know, cheap and fossil fuel energy, we find new ways to harvest this energy that is quite creative, you know, going 1,000 meters down under the ocean's surface, finding new locations and finding new forms of fossil fuel energy to continue this dependency.
So before we get into all of the findings that you guys had in your book about this sort of path of kind of mythology creation, I guess, in part through the framing of the market economy and that sort of a thing, as well as the political part of it, I was thinking about if your argument is that capitalism itself is incompatible with a finite resourced planet, or if it's this particular form of capitalism. Have you gone that far down the path? Christopher Wright, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the issue is the capitalist economic system in a sense, because trying to imagine some other form of capitalism is almost impossible. We are where we are, and it's based upon large global corporations and state government assistance for those corporations to continue to grow. And so we have the sort of bizarre example here in Australia and in the US and other places where governments are very close allies in this continued process of creative self-destruction. They're the ones that will underwrite the laws and allow the corporations and the state-owned enterprises to go into the Arctic as the ice is melting to drill for oil, to access the tar sands in Athabasca, to do the deep water oil drilling wherever it is, to despite the fact that we can see now that the impacts of that are profound, that we actually need to pull back. And rather than pulling back, we're pushing the accelerator ever firmer to the floor. To talk about it, whether it's this particular form of capitalism or some other form of capitalism, we have a global system of corporate funded capitalism, I suppose, and that is the problem, because it's predicated upon continuing the process, accelerating the process, even though the science is saying we need to pull back.
Suppose that all of those fossil fuel industries, all of those corporations decided suddenly, I know this is me dreaming, but decided suddenly that they were going to invest in solar, wind, and geothermal. Well, even geothermal could create problems, I know, but suppose they went, all right, you're right, we're going to go all out for renewable energy in the way that, you know, say Mark Jacobson has advocated. Would we still have this problem because of the nature of the economic system, or would we be able to solve the problem? And this is kind of one of the questions you started to work with in the thing with the green tech and why the solutions aren't working. And so I wanted to sort of do this thought experiment.
Yeah, no, I think what your thought experiment can do is slowing down the problem. Obviously, if we move swiftly towards renewable energy, including all of fossil fuel, we will slow down the problem somewhat. But that, as you suggest, doesn't go to the basics of the economic system, which is still is growth. So with this shift, we could slow it down, and but that would also require capitalism to not grow. And the only time we have seen CO2 emissions somewhat slowing down was during the financial crisis, when the global economy took a breath in rather than just pushing forward. So the basis of capitalist growth, because you would not invest your money in a company or in a corporation or an industry unless you assume those money is going to grow. So unless we deal with growth within capitalists, it doesn't really matter what kind of shift we're doing, because we're just going to end up with different type of limitations.
Wow. Anything you would add to that, Chris Wright?
Yeah, well, there is a sort of a thriving argument now about whether it is possible to decouple economic growth from the material impacts that we have on the environment. And various people have written on this. And the problem is essentially, can we have growth that doesn't have a climate impact? And the research suggests we can't, that getting a sort of an absolute decoupling, or even a relative decoupling between growth and climate impacts or other material impacts, other planetary boundary impacts, is very, very difficult. And as Daniel mentioned, the only times we've seen at least a plateauing in carbon emissions have been in periods of pretty major economic recession, the 2008 financial crash, the fall of the Eastern Bloc in the late 80s, where you had mass human suffering because the whole economic system collapsed. And indeed, sort of the studies that have been done suggest that to sort of get to the levels of decarbonisation we need something paralleling the sort of the fall of the Eastern Bloc, or probably worse than that, to sort of deal with the level of degrowth that we need.
Wow. So then let's talk a little bit about what your findings were in the book in terms of why the environmental initiatives deteriorate, which is, of course, embedded in this system. Can you walk us through how you see it happening? Like, you looked through it in terms of phases, like there are these phases in making these green efforts. How would you break that down for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the first phases, I guess, is a response to critique. So when environmental consequences become bad, mostly at a sort of a local level, polluted waterways, polluted airways, as you saw in the 1950s and 60s and 70s in the US and other places, governments were pushed to intervene and pass laws for clean air and clean water and what have you. And there was an immediate response from businesses that were the major culprits there. They realised that they'd attempted to resist the regulation had come in. So their response was essentially to say, yep, fair cop, there'd been some bad actions here, but we can show that we're good corporate citizens, we can invest and show that we're engaging with cleaning up our act around environmental management and these sorts of things. And so there was this immediate move towards promoting the idea of corporate environmentalism, that corporations could be trusted to self-regulate on these issues. And then when we get to the 1980s with the rise of sort of neoliberal economic theory in most of the Western democracies, there's an embrace of this idea, this movement away from state regulation of corporate action towards self-regulation of industry. And so the sort of the whole corporate environmentalism flip is a quite clever strategy to incorporate the critique and then throw it back and say, well, look, you don't need to regulate us now. We're good corporate citizens. We're good stewards of the environment. You can trust us.
And I guess the continuation of that is then that you push any action towards the consumer as an individual being. Because mm-hmm. that if you then have a corporate capitalists as taken for granted as the system, the obvious solution to any environmental problem is for the consumer to act accordingly. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want these things to happen, you shouldn't buy this product.
Right. So then it, of course, takes also the attention away from the government and the governmental yes. action, and also the democratic role of citizens.
Yes, because you're not a citizen anymore. You are basically just a consumer.
You're a consumer, right, which then actually feeds into the narrative, which is what we should talk about next, is you talk about this sort of corporate hegemony narrative, this market hegemony narrative, and how that sort of has infiltrated everything. And it's almost like this big mantra that there is no other reality.
Well, I mean, a great example of that is the current sorts of debates about how can we respond to the climate crisis and what actions can I take as an individual? So committing not to fly, not to eat meat, to buy the carbon offsets, to buy the, whatever it is, dolphin-friendly tuna. You know, the list goes on and on and on. And it's a very neoliberal response to a systemic crisis that the answer is individual actions, which, of course, doesn't really deal with the problem. I mean, there is an argument to be made that powerful, charismatic individuals in society can make symbolic actions which have a political impact, and that's the case. But to sort of assume that if we could all make little one degree of little difference, this would accumulate, you know, a systemic change is fanciful.
Before you go on that, are you arguing in this case that we can't collectively make a difference if we did all stop being such mad consumers? And I say mad in terms of like the degree rather than the insanity or emotion. So, for example, if everybody did shrink their carbon footprint, would it not make a difference?
Of course, it would make a difference. But the key is that collectively you have to shift from being individual consumers to being collective citizens. So we act collectively to push for legislation, to push for change to how we organize ourselves. And it's not that consumers are blind to this. I think the problem is rather that we cannot see or allow to see an alternative. So most consumers, I think, today realize what they do have very limited impact. We do a bit of it, all of us, me included, to minimize our harm, and we should all be good citizens as such. But we also realize that even if corporations do something really bad, say lie to all of their consumers about the emissions of the cars, that doesn't impact the corporations anymore, because we do not assume corporations act according to society's interest. Mm. The problem is there is no alternative. Mm. So we cannot see an alternative system which only makes us consumers. So even if we recognize this social contract is broken, we still have only that social contract to act on. So in an abusive relationship, in the sense of that no matter what the partner does to us, we cannot see another way.
That's a really interesting analogy. Can you match that up into the hegemonic narrative that we've been talking about?
Yeah, the hegemony here is, I guess, and Chris has referred to this earlier, that there is dominant groups in society, and with this we basically talk about the dominant industries forming a capitalist hegemony, which is supported by government. So that means that we as citizens cannot rely on the government to legislate the corporations, because the hegemony, the dominant interests, are shared by these large group of society. So there is a consensus of how we should go forward. So even in the US, even if you have Democrats or Republicans, they would both agree on corporate capitalist solutions to climate change.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we are talking about what is necessary to stop or at least slow down the climate catastrophe. What I picked up from your book as well and other studies is that it's also the hegemonic myth that the market is the only, it's like the God, the market is God thinking, even though nobody would articulate it quite like that.
Yeah, and it's more than that. It's such a level of assumed natural being that, you know, nobody questions it. So it becomes this sort of mythology that's so ingrained that to talk otherwise is to be seen as a sort of sign of madness. I mean, on the hegemony, you know, Australian context, just been researching and writing this, we have the coal industry. I mean, Australia is the biggest exporter of coal and gas in the world. And there's this amazing parallel in the language that our politicians, federal and state, use around the defence of coal and gas and the expressions that come from the industry groups and the major fossil fuel corporations. In fact, to some extent, the politicians are more extreme. Like their defence of the industry is more pronounced. So this sort of hegemony is this combination of government and industry. And I think it's Naomi Klein has this statement that, you know, in Australia, it's hard to know where the coal industry ends and the government begins because they are so embedded and interlinked. And I think you see the same thing in many other resource-oriented economies in the US and Canada and elsewhere, that there has been this complete co-option of government within the sort of the value system and thinking of a fossil fuels forever imaginary.
So it's a bit of a persuasion within the powers that be, probably. I would argue that in the US, that's partly related to the elections and mass media and that sort of a thing about who can get elected and why in the campaign finance system, et cetera, and has sort of shaped power in that direction.
It's also socially embedded. I mean, if you look at the revolving door appointments between government and industry, where people come from industry and become politicians and advisors go back into industry groups, they are part of the same social network. They share the same language. So this sort of embeddedness is not just limited to discourse. It's socially embedded at a very fundamental level.
It's an interesting sociological problem as well as an interesting communication problem. But I don't see a way of breaking out of it.
No, I think it's going to be problematic. And it has to be through some form of grassroots mobilization. When we have seen larger shift in society, it has rarely come from the dominant institutions. Rather, you know, if you in the US look at civil rights movement or and other movements around the world, that normally comes from already marginalized groups or those weaker aspects of society that is eventually convincing the other people in society that the cause is right and just. So I think for us to do any shift, we would need to see this coming from below. And to some degree, we are seeing that in many countries where students now are taking this much more serious than most politicians do. And they are much more informed than the politicians are. So we can see this kind of mobilization, but we also see the clear resistance from the dominant groups in calling these students, you know, ill-informed, that they should go back to school, that they don't know what they're talking about, and they should leave it to the politicians and the corporations to sort this out, which they obviously can and are not willing to do. So any hope would be from below and assisting in this protest, assisting, joining these marches and joining these demands. That's the only way we can make any shift.
Yeah, look, I'd agree. I mean, even just the last 6 months, if you look at the example of the global school strikes and Greta Thunberg, the phenomenon of Extinction Rebellion, I mean, these are small partial movements, but they have changed the political discourse in some pretty fundamental ways. You know, the number of governments and cities that are declaring a climate emergency, again, it's a symbolic thing, but it's important politically. And then I guess the flip side to that is the strength of the response, the pushback from governments to these sort of passive resistance type movements, quite extreme sort of authoritarian responses. So that's an indicator, I guess, that they are having an impact. They are changing the discourse or threatening the discourse, the dominant discourse. And so that's a sign of hope, I think, as well.
So one of the things, so I am a political scientist, and one of the things it seems to me is that the movements that don't actually enter the power structures, meaning run for office, get into positions of political power, actually vote, have the least amount of success. So, you know, I know you guys referenced it. I don't remember if it was an article or a book. You talked about the civil rights movement in the United States. But they worked with power. They went to the institutions. They entered the halls of power. The problem potentially with students is that they don't have votes unless they can persuade people in power, their parents, perhaps.
Mm, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The judges, perhaps. But then, of course, you're up against other counter movements that are happening at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, there's a marvelous example of this sort of effect of children on their parents and their families a couple of years ago now, where a group of young people occupied what was going to be the extension of Heathrow Airport. And they were arrested and were facing some serious jail time in a pretty repressive response from the government. And one of these young people's father was a former executive, I think at Shell, like essentially the former CEO. And he had a sort of an epiphany, and he was out the front of the court singing with protesters, justifying what his daughter had done. And in fact, they were released and got to jail. But you find these instances of powerful individuals who, when confronted by the children's action, are having to rethink the sort of the dominant sort of value systems that they had. And perhaps that's a sort of indicator of how the voice of the children can act to sort of reshape the way powerful individuals think.
So one of the other things you guys wrote about was the marketization of climate change. It sounded like you were saying this is a big part of the problem. Can it be part of the solution?
Returning to our previous discussion about capitalism, it can be part of, I guess, slowing down, but it cannot be part of the solution, in that this marketization of responses would mean that climate change in different ways becomes incorporated into the global capitalism, where if we're going to respond through mitigation, we would then have some form of trading scheme of carbon, which would obviously need to fit a growth agenda somehow. Otherwise, the corporations and government would not feed into this carbon scheme. Similar at the local level, we see where adaptation, instead of relying on legislation, we see adaptation measures being incorporated, where corporations has a bigger role to play in adapting societies or communities for future and present climate change impact.
There's also some really rather bizarre sort of examples where entrepreneurs and corporations are looking for spaces in around climate where they can create profitable ventures, whether it's sort of disaster response or, accessing areas of geopolitical instability as a result of climate change, and there's some security services. There's a whole lot of sort of vulture capitalism going on around the sort of the climate crisis as well.
Given your interviews, because you interviewed a lot of senior managers in corporations, there are a lot of things I find fascinating about that. First is that they were probably pretty forthright with you, not really quite getting the issue the way that you guys see it. Did you get a sense that there was a denial of the problem? Did people not really comprehend the degree of threat that humanity is actually facing?
Well, some did and some didn't. I mean, a lot of our respondents were in the sort of sustainability space, inverted commas, and some had come from a sort of environmental background. So they a lot of them got the climate science, and a large proportion were actually aware of how late in the day it was. Against that, though, you would find others, more senior possibly in the energy resources sort of sector, who are in a state of interpretive denial, I guess, not perhaps the literal science denial that we see on the televisions. And so they would be talking back the urgency, talking about the need for a sensible response, a market response, a price on carbon. Slowly we'll we'll solve this, we have time. And then there were others we encountered that were the full literal denial. And when that happened, I guess our jaws dropped to some extent because we were sort of surprised that intelligent people had those sort of views. They were more forthright in questioning the science, I guess, which was kind of surprising.
Anything that you would add, Daniel, on that?
I think it's important also to note that we are all in denial in some aspects here. That, you know, facing climate change head on is almost impossible as a human being in imagining what we are facing, what our children are facing. So we're all slightly in denial by continuing our lives. I mean, there is no other option than continue our lives, but we go on as if, most of us go on as if nothing bad will happen, and it already happening. So I think to the defense, we all is somewhat in denial of what will come and the consequences of what we are doing. And I think a lot of the interviews were intelligent, well-informed people. And, you know, they struggle with this just as all of us are. And they had these roles, and many of them had this role in the hope that they could make it just a little bit better. So I guess it's the classic drug dealer's defense that, you know, you'd rather have me selling drugs to your kids who is a good person than, you know, really bad people in this position. So I think these are intelligent, good-natured people in most cases who try to do the best. And I think they are suitable for these roles because they will try harder than most.
So it's sort of that idea of good intentions sort of paving the path to hell?
Yes.
One of the issues is, you know, people go to work every day. Mm. You know, we have to continue our lives. We go to the grocery store. We take our kids to school, whatever that happens to be, because you're either part of a society or you're not. And so if the society doesn't act as a whole, then you're an anomaly. And if you're an anomaly, then you're an outcast. And if you're an outcast, then you can't function. And so it just becomes a whole kind of vicious circle issue.
Yeah. And that is just exactly why we need to shift our identities from being consumers to being citizens.
Yes. Yes, you talked a bit about identities in the book as well. I assume this is part of it, but I think there are other aspects of this as well. It's our values, our identities, how we define ourselves. That I think that sort of incorporates with the other ideas that you put forward. You know, deep ecologists have been talking about this for a very long time. You know, we are not separate from the environment, and nature has a value that is not necessarily something you can put a price tag on. And if we could start to shift that thinking of separation and value and incorporate that into our identities, perhaps that's part of the solution. Maybe that's part of the narrative.
Well, yeah, there were a few of our respondents that had sort of gone to some extent down that path. And we talk about identities that they were working in, working for one of the biggest mining companies in the world. And he had this basically sort of epiphany breakdown where he realized he had to leave that company, he had to be more active in politics, sell his house, embrace permaculture, sell the car, not fly, all of these things, and sort of try and live that, live those values. So some of them get to this sort of stage, or some of us get to this stage where we sort of confront the nature of the crisis and how do you exist and live in a society which is predicated upon the machine, the treadmill continuing. So it becomes quite cathartic, quite corrosive of your whole sense of being to some extent. And that's a very tough place to be emotionally and in terms of your identity.
When we come back, what economic systems might work on a planet with the finite capacity to sustain life? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What economic systems might work on a planet with the finite capacity to sustain life? What fundamental changes do we need from societies and the economic system to stem a climate change-induced collapse? These are some of the issues covered in the book, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Corporations, Processes of Creative Self-Destruction. The authors are with us. Daniel Nyberg is a professor of management at the University of Newcastle School of Business. And Professor Christopher Wright is with us, and he is a professor of organizational studies at the University of Sydney. Perhaps you've updated these ideas a little bit, but you had, I think, six movements that you talked about. And one we were just briefly discussing, which is our relationship to nature. The biocentrism is, I think, the way you guys articulated it. Can this be changed? What's required? How do we change this?
I mean, first of all, it requires us to be willing to accept a different way of life and measuring our well-being in different terms. It will require us to not be used to the type of consumption we have been used to. So in that sense, we need to have something taken away from us. Mm-hmm. And for that to be accepted, I think we need to be slightly different human beings, where we're not caught up in consumption as the primary way for our identification. So in that sense, I mean, there has been, I mean, there are people and that may not necessarily identify foremost through their consumption. And we probably can see that, and we identify with perhaps nature, with friends, with family, and so on. That is, but we need to be willing to let go of some of our material wealth. Otherwise, we cannot.
Yeah, and that's particularly hard if we look at the sort of the dominant culture and having just, what was it, Black Friday, one of those shopping sprees they had, which is all over the internet. If you look around, I mean, our society is so embedded in consumption and more, and it's force-fed through media, et cetera. So that's a very tough thing to sort of confront and challenge and overcome. And in a sense, my own feeling is that perhaps it's going to be forced upon us, that the sort of the environmental breakdowns that we're starting to see, the extreme weather events, that it will take these sort of shocks to possibly reshape people's thinking. So that will be forced upon us to some extent. We've already seen that with examples like, you know, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and other places. These things are going to happen with increasing ferocity and speed, and that might be one way in which our thinking is recalibrated.
It does seem to me that these things happen and then we just sort of put Band-Aids on the problem, increase more Band-Aids, respond to this one and then respond to that one. And you run over there and you like spin that plate a little bit, keep it from falling, or maybe it falls, so you sweep it up, you know, to use an analogy of plate spinning.
Thoughts and prayers, yeah.
But you said there should be no distinction between culture and nature. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so I guess the distinction between culture and nature is a philosophical distinction that's been part of the last few hundred years in many ways, in that we are the masters of the universe. And I think with climate change, we're now perhaps realizing that this is not the case, that you know, materially we are not separated from nature. We are a product of nature. And that cultural distinction that we see ourselves as different to animals, to other aspects of the planet, we see as the masters of the universe, is problematic in that we can then not have a more welcoming position to other species, for example, that we take for granted that we can use animals for consumption and in a quite thoughtless way today, that we no longer even recognize when we're eating meat because it just shows up on our plate. And this has increasing over the last, 70, 80, 90 years, in the sense of before there was a realization that when you slaughtered an animal, there was a form of sacrifice there. That sacrifice is completely gone, in that we now are so separated from nature that we're not realizing when we're eating animals anymore. It just becomes a habit for us to see ourselves as distinct from nature.
Or buying timber, lumber for the house. You don't see that you had to destroy a tree for that, or
No,
yeah.
so that is a clear disconnect between our cultural living and the nature we are so dependent upon, which we now are. And what one could hope is the climate change and the environmental movement is allowing us to reconnect to nature, to be more careful about what we do.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, the climate crisis has sort of put the lie to or revealed the conceit of sort of industrial society. So the point that when we discovered, you know, when was it, back in the late 1700s, that we could burn coal to produce heat, to boil water, to produce energy, you know, steam power, there was this sort of argument that we were somehow free from nature, could bend nature to our will through this fossil fuel energy, and I think it's Naomi Klein sort of talks about, we no longer had to build our factories next to streams or wait for the wind to blow from a certain direction to sail our ships. We were sort of free from nature. And in a sense, climate crisis has revealed, well, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, nature's biting back now and saying, well, now you're going to have to pay for that. Mm-hmm. All those carbon emissions are coming back and forcing us to, in a sense, reconnect with the fact that as a species, we are reliant on a habitable climate and clean water and clean air. And if we ignore that, there are pretty severe consequences.
One of the other of the six movements that you talked about was this disruption of language or biosemiotics, new conditions of meaning. And you discussed some different phrases like spaceship Earth, Gaia, economic growth is cancer. What is necessary and how do we get this across?
Yes, good question. I guess... Chris and I have struggled a lot with this and how we can imagine otherwise in forming our language to climate change suitable in that sense, that we are describing and explaining the events using a different form of language that then inform our practices. The basic idea is that our way of talking and communicating, broadly speaking, our language is so important in informing and who we are and what we do. So we need to think about different ways of talking about this. And we gave a couple of examples there, but the basic gist is that the not taken for grantedness of our system need to be disrupted. And language is one way of doing this, where words or identities or aspects of society that we normally seen as natural or good, like the market, need to be questioned. So, you know, throughout history, we have seen where certain words and language has been in and out of fashion and have different type of connotation. So we need to change the meaning of these words. So when we talk about capitalism, it's not a taken for granted thing. It is a constructed thing that in human history is quite new. So using the language that allow us to see the meaning behind the words and challenge that. That's, I guess, is the basics. But also then when we talk about different aspects of nature, that we realize what we're talking about, that there's an embodiment of those thoughts and meanings when we talk about it. So I guess the point is that we scratch the language to reveal what we really mean by using these words.
And there's some good people doing some really interesting work on that now. As you said, the book was written some years ago, and there's people like Len Albrecht, for instance. He has a book called Earth Emotions, which is sort of all about this idea of new language, new phraseology to try and capture what's going on. He was the guy who coined this term solastalgia. There's a new lexicon for the Anthropocene. So there are these sorts of examples now coming where researchers and others are sort of developing a new language for the new age that we now live in.
Mm. So one of the other things you talked about, which is actually being explored in New Zealand as well as in Ecuador, is this idea of giving rights to nature itself.
Well, it's the old idea of sort of giving nature legal standing in some form. We cite those examples in Ecuador and the river in New Zealand as sort of examples of this trend. And that's quite a powerful, I think, sort of way in which we can use existing institutions and systems to sort of shake up the languages we were talking about the previous point, to sort of consider these things might have, these entities might have a sort of a legal standing with consequences. And I'll let Daniel talk further about that, but one of the added things there is that one of the trends that we're starting to see now within the climate crisis are these increasing numbers of legal suits and legal actions against governments and against fossil fuel corporations. The United States versus Juliana, for instance, in Oregon State in the US, is a good example of that. And that's another way of sort of upping the pressure on the powers that be, that, you know, these actions are going to have consequences for you too, potentially. So giving rivers or forests a legal standing is another sort of bow in the armory of potential legal action to force change.
So is this happening in other places in terms of the rights that you know of, or is it still pretty much restricted to places like Ecuador and New Zealand, small countries? Would it ever happen in Australia?
I don't think so, given that we've just, well, Indigenous communities have been fighting for years to prevent people walking on Uluru, and that's just come to pass, but significant pushback from the usual suspects on that. We've got the example that the largest sort of living organism on the planet, the Great Barrier Reef, we lost half of that in two summers of coral bleaching, and yet the powers that be, political and corporate, have been spinning that for what it's worth in terms of it's not climate change, it's not that bad, it's not happening, don't scare the tourists. So going the next step of, say, let's give the Great Barrier Reef a legal standing, a legal entity that it could, you know, bring action against coal mining companies. In Australia, that's a long stretch. We're not even close to that.
I know in the US, a lot of those lawsuits that the environmental organizations use are based on the standing of the person who is being harmed by not having, say, the barrier reef. We didn't have it in the US, but, you know, say an animal goes extinct or something to that effect, that the lawsuit is that I have the loss because I don't get to see that bear or whatever the animal is. Is there anything like that in Australia? Can people bring suit in that way? Because there is a harm.
Yeah, there is a harm. I mean, I'm not a legal scholar, and there are people I know who would give you a very good legal response on that. But I'm not aware of that happening. I mean, it's not within the current discussion. The current discussion in Australia, as it is in the US, is all about how can we get coal and gas out of the ground quicker? How can we push against environmental activists and put them in jail if they decide to sort of lock onto a rail or a coal loader or whatever? So the legal discourse in Australia is all the other way. How can we stop the protesters from protesting? How can we ensure that coal and gas is exported in greater and ever quantities?
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we are talking about what is necessary to stop or at least slow down the climate catastrophe. You guys did talk with people in coal and gas, and how do they justify to do this?
We're currently writing some stuff on this, and I mean, publicly, I mean, it's very polite because you can't come out as a major listed corporation and say, well, I don't believe in climate change, because that, unless you're, you know, tech industries or something in the US. But in Australia, it just sort of doesn't happen. Even the industry associations have pulled back from it. So we recognise climate change, we recognise the science, but, you know, mining, coal mining and gas provide enormous revenue to the Australian economy. We're big jobs creators in regional centres. Then the next step is to say, well, given that, we need moderation in policy. We can't have a, you know, $30 a ton carbon price or whatever it is, even that's quite small. And then the next step is, well, given we recognise it, we have to keep coal going, we're coming up with solutions, carbon capture and storage.
Clean coal.
Clean coal. Our coal is cleaner. So there's this discursive sort of process of minimising the policy implications. And then the ultimate, I think the fascinating argument is sort of a response to the moral critique. Australian coal is bringing developing economies, developing people out of energy poverty, which was a tagline developed by Peabody Energy in the US. And the Australian coal companies have latched onto that one because it's sort of a moral justification for continuing what they're doing. So they go through this process of justification, which is a slippery slope to, we'll just keep doing what we're doing.
They have to live on the planet too. I guess that's where the disconnect is. It's a bizarre sort of way of thinking.
Two things there very quickly, and I'll hand over to Daniel. I mean, firstly, they're very short-term in perspective. So what the game they're playing is essentially, as ex-insiders from the industry term it, predatory delay. They're trying to ensure that they can kick the can down the road, keep the coal and gas going, next 6 months, next year, next 5 years. And so their time frame, even as individuals, I think is quite short term. It's about the next annual general meeting, the next sort of profit report, what have you. And so I don't think they're thinking even 10 years out, 15 years out, what's going to happen. And how they square that in terms of their relationships to their children, I have no idea.
Daniel?
Yeah, no, I think Chris is basically right that they are, and we've seen that development in corporate capitalists with shorter and shorter cycles and harder profit from shareholders and harder pressure from shareholders on profit. So that cycle, I think, is spinning quicker now than it did, say, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think that short-sightedness is part of the problem. But I also think this is not too dissimilar from other industries we've seen and how they reacted, say, tobacco industry, that they were clearly trying to delay what they knew was coming as long as possible. And you know, cigarette executives have children too. And I think we are quite good at justifying what we do in the sense of, if I don't do it, someone else will. And I know I have to put bread on the table and so on and so forth. And in a sense, it is a difference in, I guess, but it's only a degree of difference in how we justify our own consumption. Oh, I have to fly to that conference. Or, well, if I don't go to that conference, someone else's will. Or if I don't eat that beef, someone else's will. Oh, the cow is already dead.
If we go from here, what you've proposed is sort of disruption thinking, but mm-hmm. that's also long-term. I mean, do we have time?
You go, Daniel.
The short answer is, I guess, no. We do not have time. We're already on borrowed time. We will face horrible consequences of this. What we can aim towards, of course, and I think it's worth fighting for human civilization. And what we are now fighting for is not a future without massive disruption of civilization. We all gone beyond that. But I still think civilization is worth fighting for. So any form of disruption, slowing down, is worth doing. So we're not saying we need one solution. We need all of it. We need push the current legal institutions. We need to somehow slow down corporate capitalism. We need to replace this with alternative forms of organizing. We need to do all of these things because it is worth fighting for.
I suppose one big part of it, you know, we talked about the values, and people are shaped by their values, and communication shapes the values and as well. I suppose the incentive systems are one place to look.
Yeah.
Chris, your turn.
One of the incentives would be, I guess, you know, the future generations angle, you know, the children, et cetera. And so that's possibly why that whole school climate strike thing is so powerful, because it is the next generation in your face saying, well, you caused this, boomers, what are you going to do about it? And in terms of other incentives, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, the economists talk about the market incentives and all that sort of thing, but as we've seen, the economic system is so short-term, it's blind to the consequences of what's happening. And this sort of idea of the sort of society, the economic system as a treadmill, a sort of a momentum, a leviathan that continues. I think there's a lot of truth in that. It was a paper just the other day on social media about climate scientists talking about the idea of the Titanic and the iceberg, that old metaphor. And when we get to a stage where we're beyond, we know we'd have to do something, but we know it takes so many miles for the ship to stop or avert course. And we're sort of at that stage where we've passed the point where we need to avert course and we're going to hit the iceberg. And so it's a question of harm minimization. Can we sort of turn down the curve and how bad those sort of impacts are going to be?
Right. And I suppose the more this culture of individualization gets propagated, the harder it is to work as a community.
Yes, I think this is detrimental, and that's corporate capitalism in its essence, is that corporations obviously want us to be consumers foremost, because that is the product or service they're selling. And to be citizens, we need to be collective. And I guess this incentive here is, and I think you know, the human brain would equally respond to different types of rewards and incentives that we respond to short-term material impact. So if we get these movements, you know, there is probably incentives for us in getting wins, collective wins, being citizen, getting our voices heard, feeling connected to friends and families. These are clear incentives to us, and we feel better for it. Mm. We feel better when we give someone a gift than we do when we receive the same value of the gift. So this is nothing about human nature, quite the opposite. Human nature would lean into being a much friendlier and careful citizen living on this planet.
If that was, in fact, the cultural values that were propagated.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we need to shift. We need to shift the rewards from being material rewards. I mean, coming up to holiday seasons here, this idea that we have to reward each other with things we're not going to use is quite insane.
There are people like Elon Musk, for example, who pushed the solar panels onto the houses in an easier way, which could make a difference. And I, as I think about that, I think, well, what it does, of course, is kick the can down the road, but maybe in time to come up with other solutions.
Yeah, well, I mean, this sort of argument towards a sort of a massive societal change towards renewable energy at scale, I mean, there's certainly merit in that argument around decarbonizing our energy system, our electricity systems, which is the low-hanging fruit. And then looking at what do we do with transport? Can we move to a hydrogen economy where hydrogen is produced with renewables? All the stuff Mark Jacobson's talked about and Al talks about. So that renewable reinvention sort of thing, I think that's the tag we use in the book, has merit. And it will probably be driven within a market mechanism given the falling price of solar PV and lithium-ion batteries and all that stuff. And that's great. But as we were saying earlier, that isn't going to really solve the problem.
Yeah, it just buys us time.
It buys us some time.
But time is an important, you know, valuable thing. It gives us time to come up with another model, perhaps, for the economy.
Yes, but that time is only useful if that time is used to change the values. Right. And if you now let corporations come up with renewable technologies or geoengineerings that buy us time, if we then depend on these corporations, they are not going to promote values that is contrary to capitalism. So the time we are buying using corporations are only used for corporate solutions.
So are you proposing ultimately an entirely different economic system?
We need more than one system, I guess. The problem with capitalism is that it's only one system and it's a dominant system and we cannot think outside that system. There are different forms of organizing societies and we need all of them and we need to experiment all of them to see which one would fit this situation the best. So we're not promoting a single alternative, we're promoting, look, how can we locally organize food? All right, we can do that through this type of organization. All right, how can we organize national aspects? Well, this requires a different type of system. Mm. The problem today is that we can only see corporate capitalism.
Yeah. Any final comments, Chris?
Well, I guess, yeah, I don't want to end on too grim a note, but come back to the point that I think we strive for alternatives and for better outcomes. As we've seen with the science, I mean, sort of yesterday's worst case is today's best case scenario. So in a sense, I think we've woken up too late, probably 30 years too late, in terms of averting some pretty catastrophic impacts. And we're going to see them play out in the next several decades. I mean, I'm looking out at the sky in Sydney today and it's just covered in bushfire smoke, can't see very far. And so those sort of impacts are going to become the new norm. And my worry is I'm not convinced human civilization is particularly resilient. I mean, resilience is this big buzzword at the moment, but I think once energy supplies are threatened, food supplies are threatened, we've seen what happened in the Arab Spring, the wheels can come off the cart pretty quickly. And then there's the space for authoritarian responses. And
yeah.
Our governments are already playing with sort of, you know, specific solutions and what have you. So I hope I'm not correct in that assumption, but I have a somewhat pessimistic view about how our global leaders, political and corporate, will actually respond when things really start to get awry.
Daniel, can you end us on a positive note? I'm just kidding.
Chris and I, with a colleague, has also written a little bit about this notion of hope without optimism. Mm. So when we talk about hope, we normally refer to optimism or a form of utopia that it's going to be better. I'm convinced we are facing something that leading human civilization towards the worst. But for us, it's an important to find hope still in this situation. So hope without optimism is this idea that there is things that are important and worth doing good stuff for. So we don't become cynical or nihilistic and stop acting, because that would be detrimental. So we have to keep up our hope, because even a problematic human civilization with a lot of challenges is worth fighting for.
Mm. Well, Christopher Wright, Daniel Nyberg, what a pleasure to host you. Thank you so much for joining us on the Scholar Circle and for sharing your research with us and some ideas. And hopefully this will be food of thought for all of us.
Thank you so much for inviting us in.
Daniel Nyberg is a professor of management at the University of Newcastle School of Business. Professor Christopher Wright is a professor of organizational studies at the University of Sydney.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, contributing host Doug Becker, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.